This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
The BFM Breakfast Grill, connecting you to the top people and ideas. Presented by U-Mobile.
BFM 89.9. I'm Philip C and welcome to The Breakfast Grill. On today's Breakfast Grill, we will be having a panel discussion on public transport in the Klang Valley following the announcement of MRT3. How will this new line change connectivity and will it be able to switch commuters from their cars to public transport? And in the process, how will this shape our city? To help us answer these pressing questions, joining us today is Hamdan Majid. He's the Managing Director of Think City. Azif Azuddin, you're an independent urban mobility researcher who is an active participant in many public transport think tanks and working groups, such as Transit Malaysia. Azif, I want to just start with you. A 50-kilometre plus line, 30 stations. Now, in the bigger scheme of things, can you perhaps share with us how significant MRT3 is in terms of improving urban public transport in the Klang Valley?
I think this is a very significant project, actually, because it's a circle line, right? And if you think about circle lines in many different cities elsewhere, circle lines are intended to make journeys more efficient because the idea is to connect users through a loop where they can exchange to different lines efficiently. So the idea that a circle line is being implemented in Kuala Lumpur, in Greater KL, Klang Valley, means that this is an attempt to basically allow travel for much efficient traveling in Greater KL. However, there's no definitive answer. Ideally, this would help commuters, I think, travel more efficiently around the Greater Klang Valley. And yet, it is a major, major project. I think most cities that have circle lines are indicative of a mature public transportation system.
Can you give us some examples of which cities have these circle lines? I mean, I study in the UK, so we are very familiar with the very famous yellow circle line in London. Could you give us some examples of where this circle line is quite prevalent across the world?
Yep, you just mentioned the very main one everyone knows about, which is the circle line in London. But of course, there is the also very popular and very well-known Moscow circle line, which is very well loved by transit users all over the world who know them. But then there's also in Japan, right, in Tokyo, the Yamanote line, which is itself a circle line. So yes, I mean, there are several circle lines around the world. Even in Singapore, we have the circle line, which functions to help users transfer from one line to another.
And historically, I mean, for Malaysia, we have had actually linear lines, correct me if I'm wrong, MRT1, MRT2 lines. They basically have an origin and destination point. But MRT3, Hamdan, isn't a new project, isn't it? It's been mooted multiple times. My memory serves me right. In 2018, you know, it was hotly debated with the Pakatan Harapan government at the time. They said that they were going to put it on hold, put it on ice due to fiscal considerations. So I'm wondering really, whether do we really need MRT3? Because it can be said that our public finances are really not up to shape to shoulder such a large infrastructure project, isn't it?
I think it's what Azif's raised just now, to say that circle lines are there to close the loop, integrate better between different rail lines that already exist. And in fact, also complement to create a more multimodal network. This would definitely reduce travel times and would be providing wider coverage and transit times between lines to increase ridership. So greater integration with called the Greater KL Transport Network would lead to greater efficiencies and increase in public transport share. Yes, if you ask from the standpoint of they call cost and so on, our view is that MRT3 is needed. Is this the best use of public finance? Can always be debated because there's always a trade-off, right? In the sense that do you spend it on public transport or do you spend it on building a hospital or building a school. But as you know, public transport is a public good that creates significant benefits, especially when a network is built in a more cohesive and integrated manner. And in this case, you know, the circle line is pivotal to kind of create the synergy across all the different lines that already government has invested. So it's more urgently needed to ensure that you unlock the full benefit of the public transport system by allowing people to have not only ability to go more efficiently point to point, but eventually it starts contributing to build what you call agglomeration economies into the Klang Valley area, by which the people are able to move efficiently, just like in Tokyo, London, Singapore, and other parts of the world that Azif has brought up. We hope that similar outcome will be achieved in Kuala Lumpur.
And Azif, you know, just bringing you into the picture now, you know, this line is a very unique line due to its design, right, being circular in nature. But what also is pretty interesting also is that it has these 10 interchange stations. You know, one of the biggest frustrations KLites have about the current lines is that the ability to interchange is very much limited and very much the interchanges take place in the center of the city. So with this shift now, where you have these 10 interchange stations among the 30 stations, lines there with the ability to interchange across the board and across the boundary of the city per se. Tell me where the shifts in flow you expect to take place now with this introduction of the Circle Line.
If you want me to be completely honest, it's a bit too early to tell because the usefulness of interchanges actually really depends on travel patterns and behaviors, right? Where you're coming from, where you're headed to. And the point of an interchange is to make those efficient transfers. However, if we want to go into speculative territory, I suspect two stations to look into is actually Pantai Dalam in University, right? So this Pantai Dalam is connected to the KTM Tanjung Malim Port Klang line, which already has a mature ridership coming from Klang. So an exchange from Pantai Dalam to University, which is connected to the Klang Jaya line, another mature and very high ridership line, means that this makes for efficient transfers, I think, between both the Klang Jaya line and the KTM line. Or even Pandan Indah, right, up north, which is connected to the Ampang line. You can exchange in Sitia Wangsa, which is connected to the Klang Jaya line. So I think the idea here is that when you build a circle line, you connect mature riderships from far off, at least the edges of Greater Klang Valley, into a circle line that allows them to go easily into the city or to other parts of the city, right? But of course, to just give that disclaimer again, connections and transfer configurations can be endless, but it's also very speculative. And really, this depends on Klang Valley travel behaviors. And that's data that I believe Prasarana, KTM, be more privy to. And I trust the consideration existed. The alignment, when it was proposed, had these considerations as well.
So Hamdan, you know, you are very much huge proponent about how the urban landscape will evolve, very much so, right? So with this line in place, I want to get your perspective because we are seeing also this city sprawl out further, isn't it? So how does this help us perhaps concentrate into the city, or how does this help us actually regroup and reorganize ourselves better or plan better within the urban construct of our city then?
The Circle Line is a very critical infrastructure that is basically stitching the city together. As you stitch the city together, you want to achieve greater connectivity, greater ease of movement, and you want to ensure that the network effect eventually starts working. And that's essentially the intent of the whole model of building a circle line, as we have seen in many parts of the world. In the case of Kuala Lumpur, while you have alluded to the fact that the current interchange and others are planned with the view of also thinking for the future, as you build infrastructure, it also pushes the potential to think about how areas can regenerate and transform. As we have seen, many parts of the city have grown organically, and probably also to a large extent, we have seen a large amount of urban sprawl. Eventually, for KL to become a more dynamic and well-functioning city, there will be greater need for planning of TODs, particularly around the infrastructure that we have. Secondly, is that deeper consideration through the planning instrument, whereby what they call regeneration is considered in a bigger way, because it's important to understand that with the infrastructure that's being built, you want to ensure that TODs are built closer to the transit stations and not build density away from the transit stations. And greater planning regulations should be put in place that will drive that forward. Third, I would probably say that it gives a great opportunity to reframe the city, and also particularly with new thinking around the idea of 20-minute cities and so on that has emerged. How can we integrate and realize this potential? And obviously, KL is already a mature city, so any form of development will be regeneration, and those regeneration schemes should be kind of considered in a more integrated and holistic manner.
Azif?
Yes. So actually, I want to weigh in a little bit on the discussion of TODs, right? So I feel like the TOD concept, I think, tried to be materialized during the MRT1 development. But I think the problem with Malaysia, generally speaking, is that our idea or definition of TODs is not definitively TOD, right? So TOD being a transit-oriented development is where you build urban developments within the vicinity of a transit station. So you allow mobility to be quite easy for those who stay there, right? Accessible as well. You can work, play, live in an area. That's kind of like the mantra of TODs. But what we see here in Malaysia is really a corrupted version of TODs, right? Where I would rather term it as transit adjacent developments, where the transit station or the transit point exists, but it is not accessible to those who live there. It's not too accessible to those who stay there, right? The first mile gap exists in Malaysia, so it's not really, I think, definitively TODs in its truest form, I don't think exists in Malaysia. Even KL Central, I think, which prides itself as a TOD, really isn't that accessible. Pedestrian-wise, you need to drive to get into KL Central, right? Generally speaking, if you're not on a train.
Yeah, I mean, that's the biggest frustration, isn't it? Because, you know, we talk about this wonderful infrastructure project. The question will be the first mile and last mile. On the back of many people's minds, you know, how do we kind of resolve and address that, Hamdan?
In a sense that this, again, goes back to the whole notion to say that, you know, while we have built the city, but the city also needs to be rebuilt as you introduce new infrastructure and there is kind of new growth in population and reorganizing things and so on. So there will be some amount of what I call rethinking, reassessing, and adjusting. And this is what happens in many parts of the world. When you are building a metro network, it is not an infrastructure that serves for 5 years, 10 years, but it's planned to think about the next 50 to 100 years. And in the 50 to 100 years, definitely a city goes through different cycles of building and rebuilding and readjustment. As we have seen, even without metro networks, we have seen how places like Jalan Sultan and Ismail has seen a kind of reinvention every decade. And similarly, we expect with the introduction of the Circle Line, there will be greater drive towards regeneration. What we are encouraging and proposing is that the regulators who are managing the land development organize a lot more of the density around the transport hubs. So that way, then there's more people can kind of live, work, play in those zones itself within the 500 to 1 kilometer radius.
So I get your point that it's very important to make sure that we reorganize the city a bit, you know, around these locations. But eventually also we will need to contend with the short-term challenge about how do we get the first and last mile connectivity in place, isn't it, Azif? So what kind of solutions do you think we need to put in place to make sure that we get that sorted out so that the line can really drive the usage and utility that it really deserves?
Right. So when we talk about first mile, last mile, I think people would typically think of buses, they would think of ride sharing. But I think one discussion of first mile, last mile, which needs to be considered a little bit more and be made more mainstream as well, is the inclusion of micro mobility, right? So I'm talking about things like scooters, electric bikes, even walking, for example. So unfortunately in Malaysia right now, there is, or even Greater Kuala Lumpur, if I want to be more specific right now, is that our first mile, last mile infrastructure and accessibility is weak in terms, right, of maintenance, in terms of infrastructure, where even in a study that was done by Think City, if I don't recall, a few years ago on the walkability in Kuala Lumpur, it is not as pedestrian friendly as it should be. But that's exactly how you get from the stations, by walking, by taking the bus. And we are very much lacking in that area. So I believe one way to resolve this is really to beef up and invest more in first mile, last mile infrastructure, whether it be buses, whether it's pedestrian walkways, making it safer, making it more accessible, not only to those who are able, but also those who are OKU, right? Because those who wheelchairs have very much a lot of trouble going to train stations, and they prefer to drive there or take private transport to stations because our first mile, last mile infrastructure is weak.
Today on The Breakfast Grill, Hamdan Majid, CEO of Think City, and Azif Izzuddin, an independent urban mobility researcher, helping us understand how MRT3 will transform Klang Valley. After the break, we ask whether the 31 billion ringgit bill is worth its bang for one's buck. Stay tuned, BFM 89.9.
You are listening to the BFM Breakfast Grill, brought to you by U Mobile.
Welcome back. On The Breakfast Grill, we have with us Hamdan Majid, Managing Director of Think City, and Azif Izzuddin. He's an independent urban mobility researcher, as we have a discussion about how MRT3 will help shape public transport in the city. Let's talk about the business case for it, right? The bill seems to be about 39 billion ringgit. If you split it up, 31 billion for construction, 8 billion for land acquisition. Do you think this is value for money, in the words of the former finance minister, Lim Guan Eng? Hamdan?
I believe that, like I said earlier, that the network benefit, the agglomeration that it will enable to create the potential to regenerate parts of the city that has been depressed or been left out, collectively eventually contribute positively. Because like I said, you can't see the cost of public transport in isolation, but rather public transport should be seen in terms of the economic value that it's able to create across the network effect. Sometimes you will try to measure dollar and cents in terms of whether the fare that people pay will cover the cost, but that's not how it should be seen. But it should be seen more from the perspective of saying that, you know, how much it increases land value, how much does it improve in terms of efficiency, how much does it create ease of travel and so on. Because eventually those factors need to be priced in as part of the economic assessment, because at the end of the day, the public transport is an enabler, not an end point itself.
No, I totally get your point. I think also my follow-on question then is, we think about it as an enabler, but you know, my central concern also really is the situation of how the pandemic has also changed how we view public transport, right? If you think about ridership, prior to the pandemic, there were about 2 million riders per day. And during the pandemic, that really literally collapsed to 300,000. Perhaps you can say that's part of the MCO lockdown. But don't you think the pandemic would have changed sentiment and behaviours about the utility of public transport moving forward?
All right, if I look at my recent visit to Istanbul, and I saw, looking at the experience travelling in public transport in a big city like Istanbul, full. It's everyone is moving around in the public transport system, because and then that's the pathway for people to be able to move efficiently, effectively, and in an eased manner. Eventually, it's a question of choice. Obviously, public safety is important. I think public safety then is addressed by virtue of how you travel in these modes of transport. And as we come into a kind of, I call, an endemic environment where we're going to live with COVID, similar to living with flu, living with any other forms of diseases out there, it doesn't change the risk in terms of travel going into a shopping mall in a car versus traveling in the metro network, going to a shopping mall, what you got to your home.
Yeah, I completely agree with Handam actually on the point of taking public transport in that sense, right? But I also need to add here that the MRT project, the MRT 3 project is due to be completed ideally by 2030, right? So a lot can change between then and now. That's a few more years to go, right? So in terms of Klang Valley users feeling safe to take public transport again, or how much the government can incentivize us to get on the bus and train instead of driving around. So I think this is the time period between now and the completion of MRT 3 where the government needs to install policies and needs to think about frameworks of how to get people back into public transport. So I believe that in terms of getting, I think people will get back to public transport if there is incentive for them to get back on it, whether it's cost, time cost, or even financial cost, right? And certainly, I think when we talk about ridership, this ridership numbers exist. People still use public transport, even though the numbers have dipped during the pandemic. And I think the numbers are rising back up again if we refer to the statistics by MOT.
I want to build on the very interesting point about incentives, right? And again, it comes back to carrot and stick, because parallel to that whole conversation of MRT3, there also bubbled up this whole issue of congestion charging into the city. Now, the Transport Minister has already said that they will only consider implementing congestion charging once MRT3 hits a certain scale, right, in 2030. In your estimation and view, do you think that actually should be brought forward earlier, you know, and drive greater action immediately? But it's a highly unpopular move. Let's all agree on that. But the question here is the carrot and stick, isn't it? And my question to both of you, is it more stick than carrot?
I have to say that congestion charging could have been implemented a long time ago, but it's largely political and it's not logistic. It can be done. But why wait? Why wait until MRT3 is completed before congestion charging is implemented? This was mentioned, I think, three, four years ago, the same excuse was brought up by DBKL as well. So I think we need to first examine the objective of congestion charging. Why are we doing it, right? And the idea here is to reduce private vehicle use in the city, to become more environmentally sustainable so that we don't have pollution as well, and also to control traffic. And because congestion charging, the mechanism is financial, the idea here is to discourage private users by hurting their wallets, right? And yes, it's a stick approach, but it's been done in London, it's been done in Singapore, and it's quite possible to do, because essentially all you need to do is just use cameras throughout the city to capture number plates, and people can register themselves before they go in, or even after they leave the city, and they can make payments.
Sure, but Hamdan, can we only change behavior through sticks?
First and foremost, this conversation about congestion charging has been there for three decades. And it's time for action, number one. I don't think we should be delaying it, because at the end of the day, we are investing in a bigger way to build an infrastructure that basically you're saying there's an alternative for people to choose. Without alternatives, then you're punishing people. That's first and foremost, that now that we have more alternatives, we've already got all the networks coming in, MRT1, MRT2, LRT1, LRT2, LRT3, and all that. And progressively, the whole network is now maturing. So I believe they should start looking at congestion charging in parts of the city, and then progressively increase the coverage as when you deliver the infrastructure that people can have a choice in moving into. Now, number two is that, is it stick alone?
Stick alone.
I think in the case of government, they're already offering the carrot where you have the 100 ringgit travel, the 50 ringgit passes and so on. That gives what you call great amount of ease for many who are in the what you call B40 communities to be able to travel in a more cost efficient manner with a kind of option and alternative that works for many people. Aside from that, I think to educate people to say that the public transport should be a kind of used by everyone in all segments of society, as we have seen in many parts of the world where the judges travel by called the metro network, the doctor travels by metro network, the minister travels by the metro network. So I think there's a great amount of, I think, belief to encourage our senior leadership in the country to consider to do walk the talk and make it as part of our life. For me personally, I've chosen as much as possible to use public transport as the way to move forward. You know, obviously, it's a combination of public transport that we may need to use. But I believe, you know, if we don't walk the talk, we can never make the change.
Well, I guess what you're implying here is a reduction of these motorcades. But as if, you know, maybe perhaps the biggest carrot here is that we make the line and public transport access super accessible from a price point, right? But to deliver that requires us to optimize cost of this line. When you look at the design of the line, right, the way it's done above ground, underground, do you think a right balance was struck in terms of the overall cost testing and construction of the line so far so that it delivers the right ROI and cost for us to deliver this efficiently?
Right. So if you examine the MRT3 line, it's a mix of, it's a lot more overground, elevated alignments, right? That was called. There's a lot more elevated alignments, I think, coming from Jalan Kuching and all the way to university, whereas the underground alignment only exists from university all the way to Bukit Kiara South, and then from Bukit Kiara, which is a provisional one, all the way to Jalan Kuching again. So I think in terms of cost, I think there was a lot of consideration as to how we can manage the cost for the MRT3. And I think it's done all right. But then again, to be fair, this is still the early proposal stages. It's going to be undergoing a lot of changes, I think, over time once the impact assessment report is submitted, once it goes into public consultation. So what we see now may not be the final product that we get in 2030.
So what do you think will be the biggest implementation challenge of this line? Let's just give a sense of the timelines here. The construction is supposed to begin end of this year. It's going to need 5 years, right, before the first passenger takes the first ride in 2028. Where do you think the biggest hurdles of implementation be for this line?
Right. So I think land acquisition is probably one. Land acquisition is always the first major challenge because one, this determines whether stations and tracks can be built. But given by this proposal, it seems like MIT Corp is confident that this is how the alignment will look like. But however, of course, like I said earlier, the processes will change, will determine how it will look like at the very end of the day once it goes to public consultation, once it goes through impact assessment reports and otherwise. But beyond land acquisition, I think another challenge in its own right really is MIT Corp being able to maintain its commitment to its stated objectives, such as building affordable housing along the alignment. So this was pretty much sold by the MRT CEO last year when he made the presentation, is that they want to have affordable housing, but can they? Because MRT1 has proven that building affordable housing is not possible. In fact, the houses along the MRT1 are inaccessible to M40s. Secondly, as for urban regeneration, is it possible as an objective, which the CEO has committed to as well, right? If you look at Kwasaland as an example of the government hedging their bets on urban regeneration, these expectations are falling short. I mean, MRT1 started operating in 2016. When 2022 right now, and almost 6 years later, Kwasaland has two MRT stations operational but empty because planning, because of many other factors as well. But the question to me is less to do, I think, with things like acquisition, but also whether or not MRT can commit to the objectives.
Philip, I can just say about Kwasaland, I just need to be a bit of correction as if I wouldn't call Kwasaland as regeneration. Kwasaland is redevelopment.
Redevelopment, right.
It's a greenfield development. Greenfield development takes time to actually, what do you call, build communities. In the case of regeneration, where you already have mature urban infrastructure around and you already got existing community, you can actually execute successful regeneration, as has been done in many parts of the world where you are able to sustain and build community. As you've seen, like King's Cross in London and many other successful implementations.
So Hamda, can I just interject then? You know, because you have had much experience doing all this urban regeneration work, and this line is quite unique in the sense that it does traverse relatively all neighbourhoods, right? What do you want to see done parallel to this construction?
Like I said earlier, that building in the transport infrastructure is only one. Equally important is the whole planning and development that will go alongside to ensure that there is greater success in the infrastructure that's built. Number three, it's also that we got to start preparing the people to accept a new way to live and a new behavioral norm to emerge. And as I have seen this before, when LRT, Putra line was introduced in the mid 90s, there was great also reluctance for people to say that, look, I'm not going to switch from my bus into a metro network. But progressively, we have seen how 2 million riders now use this metro network. So I think it's more a process of also education and people also understanding the benefit that comes along with it.
And as if, you know, final word, right, where would you look at to further optimize the line, or how would you, you know, advise the government on further optimizing the line moving forward?
Oh, that's quite a big ask, I would say. But honestly, I think when it comes to optimization, I think, like I mentioned earlier, right, because we can expect changes to happen over time, it's a question that ultimately needs to involve stakeholders. It's not my place to say exactly, because this is a question that involves stakeholders, right? These are the lines that are going to affect. This is an alignment that is going to affect the lives of people who are staying there, the economic viability, that their cost of living as well, and basically. So this is the question that Prasarana needs to deal with. Prasarana and the residents and the businesses of those areas that they're going to build in, this project will affect them, and their needs need to be taken into consideration alongside the overarching objective of the project, of course, to close the transit loop, right? So optimization, I think if seen from a top-down view, it is quite difficult to comment on, because I feel like this sort of processes need to come from the bottom up. The people's needs and considerations as to what they really need in the area. Do they need more buses in order to get them linked to the transit station? stations? Do they need the stations to be built in a specific place where it's more connected? These are conversations that can happen only on the ground and only after being taken into consideration.
I think there's no dispute here. Bottom-up engagement is core to really make this line really effective. Gentlemen, that's all the time we have for today. Thank you for your participation and for your insights. On The Breakfast Grill with me today, Hamdan Majid, CEO of Think City, and Azif Azuddin, an independent urban mobility researcher on MRT3 and how it will transform the Klang Valley. I'm Philip C, BFM 89.9.
The Breakfast Grill is brought to you by U-Mobile, unleashing unlimited potential every day.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.